The Voice of Reason Broadcast Network presents The Orthodox Nationalist. Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson is a former professor, a professional writer, and a priest of the Ukrainian Orthodox Church. His website is rusjournal.com. That's rusjournal.com. Now here's your host, Matt Johnson.
Okay, everybody, welcome to another edition of the Orthodox Nationalist. Today, we are going to deal with something that one of my producers had recommended as a possible topic. Something that I've actually lectured on several times in the past and actually didn't consider it, kind of forgot about it, and that is the reign, or at least a summary of the reign, of Nicolae Ceaușescu in Romania. On a personal note, just a little over 20 years ago, December 25th, 1989, when Ceaușescu was executed by the army, I actually, that was the moment when I decided that I was going to do this sort of thing, for the rest of my life. And I figured if they could do it in Romania, you know, we could do it in America. To eliminate our own Ceaușescus is something, quite frankly, too exciting to pass up. And I remember that moment. I was at my sister's house and I watched a bit of the trial, and then they shot him, and it was on a bunch of the news stations at the time. And I went back to Hartford, and I went to both the poli-sci and history department and said, this is what I'm going to do. And so that was a little over 20 years ago, and it's really nice to be able to say that my career derives from the execution of such a man. But that's really the single event, a catalyst that really, you know, had me do this sort of thing, and then of course look to the Orthodox world as a subject for historical study. So we'll see how long this takes. If we come up a little short, we could do some other things. But let's say, by way of background, first of all, that Nicolae Ceaușescu leads the party from the mid '60s, from 1966 to 1989. And the Romanian Communist Party he viewed as an autonomous movement. He viewed Romania as something, as a country, a Marxist state that did not need to take orders from the Soviet Union. And remember, Ceaușescu had pulled Romania out of the Warsaw Pact. And the Soviets viewed Ceaușescu in very much the same way that they had viewed Marshal Tito in Yugoslavia, as a dangerous heretic, as somebody that needed to be controlled. In fact, not too long before his demise, he had approached the European community, now the European Union, in hopes that in some way he could insert the Romanian economy, which does contain some oil, remember, into the EU, the EC at the time. So Ceaușescu was somebody who was angling, very much like Tito was, for Western aid and Western assistance. And basically the idea, really I guess from Johnson onward in America, was that any state that sought to distance itself from the USSR became a recipient of American foreign assistance. This, by the way, is proof of a particular thesis that I've had for a long time, that the United States, during the Cold War, was not anti-communist. It supported Marxist states and supported Marxist movements with financial and military assistance. That was the case in Yugoslavia. It was the case in Romania. It was the case in China. It was even the case in South Africa, where money went to Marxist movements. The only criterion was that these movements or countries needed to distance themselves from the USSR. The fact that they remained communist states in one form or another wasn't the problem. Communism was never the problem. It was the fact, and this is the thesis in more detail, the concept is that the U.S. fought the Soviet Union not because it was anti-communist. The U.S. fought the Soviet Union because the Soviet Union threatened to create a very large, powerful trading bloc over and against U.S. dominance of the international economy. The proof of that is actually pretty endless. It is not the simple fact that the United States and her corporate world bailed out the Soviet Union over and over again from 1921 all the way up to financial aid to Gorbachev. Whenever the Soviet Union seemed on the verge of tottering, Archer Daniels Midland and a whole lot of other both food and financial organizations came to the Soviets' assistance. And of course, the irony is that as the U.S. is allegedly fighting Marxism around the globe, and so, you know, the Soviet Union is financing, whether it be the Cubans or the Sandinistas or the MPLA in Angola, wherever it was, at the same time, the U.S. is trading and giving military technology and everything else to the Soviet Union. There was nothing odd about this. And I know so many Vietnam veterans and Korean veterans, my father being a Korean veteran, and when he learned of this kind of stuff, was put out a bit that the U.S. is trading with the Soviet Union precisely at the same time as it's fighting a war, whether on the Korean Peninsula or in Indochina. So it was never the fact the Soviet Union was an enemy of the U.S. because it was Marxist. The U.S. fought alongside the Marxists against the Germans in World War II. There's obviously no problem with Marxism as such from the American side. It is, however, the fact that the Soviet Union, particularly prior to the Sino-Soviet split in the early 60s, was building an alternative trading bloc that would not be using the dollar, would not be using American banks, would be financing this trading bloc from Moscow. And the Soviets had always maintained that it was the CIA, their involvement in Chinese politics in the early 1960s, which that eventually led to the split between the Soviet Union and China. And that, of course, it was a major blow to Soviet pretensions in Asia. But, of course, it wasn't that long after that that Jimmy Carter abandoned Taiwan, and solely on the basis of the fact that the Chinese were opponents of the Soviet Union, abandoned the Taiwanese, and sponsored the admission of Red China to the United Nations. But the very fact that Ceausescu and Tito in Yugoslavia, solely on the basis that they had rejected the Soviet Union as their guiding force, immediately, without any other changes to the system, received American aid and assistance. So it wasn't as if the U.S. government went to Bucharest or to Belgrade and said, okay, you need to alter your view of the world and have elections and all this other stuff, and then you will receive American aid. They immediately received American aid solely on the basis that they weren't going to listen to the Soviet Union anymore. The same thing went for China. So obviously it's not Marxism or even Stalinism that worried the U.S. It solely was the leadership of Moscow that worried the U.S. Therefore, the very simple thesis that I've held for a long time is proven without doubt that the American government did not oppose Marxism. They supported Marxism whenever it was in their interest, including financially, including with food supplies, including with military equipment, and even shoulder-to-shoulder cooperation from the war against the Germans to the war against the South African government. CIA, KGB worked shoulder to shoulder in all of that time. Only when the Soviet Union threatened to create a trading bloc that would exclude the dollar and exclude the domination of the major banks, Goldman Sachs and the Rothschilds and everybody else who matters in that department, only then did the United States put its foot down and opposed Soviet expansionism. So that the U.S. was anti-communist is absolute nonsense. It isn't true. There are too many examples of American corporations with American state subsidies and state support bailing out the Soviet Union continuously throughout its existence, both in terms of foodstuffs as well as in technology, whenever the Soviet Union seemed to be on the verge of collapse. This was the case in 1921, all throughout the 1930s, obviously Lend-Lease during World War II, but also under Khrushchev. In fact, because Khrushchev made the very strategic anti-Stalinist speech, and at least on the surface was an anti-Stalinist, of course Khrushchev, not being a dummy, realized that with this kind of rhetoric, we will get aid from the West, because that's how the West is. They are not anti-communist. They're just opposed to our expansion into the realm of international trade and international banking. So, but in terms of the reign of Nicolae Ceausescu, he did receive, in his most violent, a Stalinist period, did receive aid and money from the West, and specifically from the CIA, solely on the basis that they had left the Warsaw Pact, and then in 1968, condemned publicly, strategically, I should say, the Soviet invasion of Czechoslovakia. And needless to say, Ceausescu was worried about himself, but at the same time, he also realizes that this is a very simple way of getting Western cash. I will condemn the Soviet Union, I will save my own skin, and I may receive, and in fact will receive, lots and lots of money from the CIA and from the ignorant American taxpayer. Okay. The second big issue is his security services. Ceausescu based his entire existence on the because, you know, economically Romania was a complete failure, partially because it was cut off from the Soviet trading bloc for some time, and not entirely accepted by the West, although financed by it briefly. Ceausescu realized that he really only had one option, and that was to rely almost exclusively on the Securitate, or the elite, extremely well-trained and well-paid police forces. These were not merely highly trained police services, but these were also the ideological backbone of the society. So it's not merely that the police were capable of keeping order in the society. They were up until 1989. The problem was that he needed this ideological movement as well, an armed ideological movement. So the Securitate wasn't just a coercive agency. So these guys were hired and trained on the basis of their intelligence, on the basis of their physical acumen, the elite of the armed forces, but also for their ideological loyalty. And in 1989, the elite units of the Securitate were the last to continue to fire on the army. I happen to believe, although it's very difficult to find direct proof of this, but I do believe that the Romanian army was never fully trusted by Ceausescu, certainly was not trusted by the Soviet Union. And of course it was the army that tried him and shot him, on New Calendar Christmas of 1989. And his wife was also politically active, Elena. And they shot the both of them. They were kind of co-leaders of the society. Securitate, therefore, in the absence of army support, in the absence of a dynamic economy — this is partially the fault of the Soviet Union, it's partially the fault of mismanagement — Ceausescu needed to rely almost exclusively on the police services for his legitimacy. Even as early as 1951, before Ceausescu took over the party, the police services really in Romania became some of the most efficient in the entire Warsaw Pact. 1951 is a watershed year here because this was the time when the police services began to exterminate political opponents of the government. 1951, right up into the 1980s, the Securitate were really had infiltrated every independent civic group in Romania, including the Orthodox Church, which is one of the most compromised, if not the most compromised, in all of Eastern Europe. And it's not an accident that the bulk of the pious Orthodox people are under the Greek old calendar jurisdiction of Cyprian of Oropos in Philia, which is not a part of the state church of Greece and is not in communion with the Patriarch of Constantinople. This is a vehemently anti-communist Greek Orthodox group that has its largest organization in Romania. Now, hundreds of parishes in Romania have been rebuilt under the Greek old calendar protectorate. But this is primarily because of the tremendous efficiency in the Securitate, in really infiltrating and dominating the church. So as far as I'm concerned, the New Calendar Church of Romania is really all that's left of Ceausescu's old system. So that's its primary legacy, so to speak. So the entire New Calendar Romanian church is absolutely Securitate created and manipulated. And so if you're a pious Orthodox person in Romania, normally what you do is you join with the Greek old calendarists under Cyprian, who last I heard is in a coma right now in Greece, and so that they were able to leave the highly compromised and corrupted Securitate Church. So as part of this movement, the Securitate also really was the envy of the Warsaw Pact for a while in building a huge network of informants in the church, in the bureaucracy, in the army, everywhere. The Ceausescu / Securitate movement really was the, you know, that was really the government. And then it was separated from the army, it was separated from the civil service, it was separated from the Communist Party. So you had a cult of personality under Ceausescu, which was undergirded by this huge network of elite Securitate combat units and this huge network of informants that organization helped put together, and really was probably one of the best and most efficient in Romania, really more than anywhere else. And I think the reason for it is fairly clear, is that Ceausescu was consistently unpopular. The economy was consistently a disaster, to the point really in the 70s and 80s as really third and fourth world status economy, partially because Ceausescu shipped out much of the industry of the country, including the oil pumping and refining industry, out of the country to pay Romania's debts. So it was quite a literal movement in the 1970s that in order to pay off the debts of Romania, that we will dismantle our industry, ship it to wherever we need to pay it, and hope that the United States will give us the cash to make up the shortfall. Now, the Americans did give Ceausescu lots of money over the years and lots of CIA support in hopes to create this satellite against the USSR. But it was never quite enough to fill the gap that Ceausescu had created with this, you know, so by the time he's executed in 1989, Romania is a fourth world state, and it remains as a fourth world state today. The third thing that the Securitate did, and this, by the way, is something that the KGB in the Soviet Union, in their operations in America, did very, very well, was spreading rumors. Anti-communist activists, both inside and outside of the country, were accused effectively of being a part of the security services, of being double agents, of working for the KGB, of working for the CIA. Whatever it took to discredit somebody, the informant intelligence arm of the Securitate was particularly effective at spreading rumors. One of the big functions of the KGB in America is to spread rumors about right-wing leaders, about the FBI, infiltrating black organizations in America and saying that the whites are going to kill you all, and so you have to arm yourselves and rise up against white people. You know, this sort of thing. I mean, the KGB was particularly expert in that area. And the Securitate also in the creation of rumors, fake political issues, all this kind of stuff, was a very, very well-oiled machine. The very fact that Ceausescu absolutely depended on the Securitate for his physical security and for the security of his government. The investment in this grew. Of course, always a black budget. You know, no one ever knew how much was actually being spent. CIA money was being funneled into the Securitate throughout the 1970s and even the early 80s. You know, it was really his only prop, particularly as the economy continued to go on its downward spiral from the 70s onward. Okay. Ceausescu had several things that were part of his long-term plan. Systemization is a watchword that is used in Romanian politics to refer to several things. Number one, a brand new approach to urban planning. Ceausescu ultimately wanted the agrarian population to become urbanized. This is one of those consistent motifs in Marxist opinion throughout the world from World War II onward. Marxism really hated the yeoman farmer. I think more than any other group of people, the yeoman farmer or the communal farmer was considered the lowest of creatures. I do think that there is a Jewish side to this, because the Talmud forbids a Jew to actually work the land. That's for goyim slaves. Ultimately, the land will be worked with machines in an urban factory environment. And in that way, Jews can actually till the land, because they're not actually working the land with their hands. They're using a machine, you know, one day maybe a computerized machine, to work the land, and in which case you're not actually manually working the land. So this is something that comes up over and over again in communist polemics. Leon Trotsky / Bernstein in Russia made it an important plank of his movement, that ultimately he will eliminate agriculture as we know it and turn it into a purely urban mechanized movement. This Jewish approach to agriculture is something that shows up quite a bit in the communist movement all over the world, that it is a strictly urban movement, especially in Europe and America. It was a strictly urban Jewish movement that viewed agriculture as the lowest of occupations. This was not the case in China. Although, of course, like everywhere else, the communist leadership promised free access to land, not bothering to tell them that, in fact, the land will be collectivized and you will not possess any of it. That, you know, Lenin made those promises, Mao made those promises. So wherever you go, including China, the agricultural world was considered the lowest. And the only way that agriculture can be saved and made into a Marxist mold is that it be purely mechanized. So there is, in fact, no physical contact between the human being, which is, in Marxist ideology, is nothing more than a machine anyway. Classic Enlightenment evolutionary thinking. Nothing more than a machine anyway. But because there is no contact between the human being and the land, a Jew, according to Talmudic law, can therefore be a part of an agricultural existence, because there really is no contact between the person and the ground. It is a purely mechanized and computerized thing. And this exists everywhere, without exception, in the Marxist universe. So, for Ceausescu, this whole notion of systemization is to create agricultural cities, and therefore to double the number of cities by 1990. And these, of course, these ideas were developed in the early 70s. To double the number of cities, to create agricultural cities, to computerize the use of the land, and therefore separating humanity from the earth in any way, shape, matter, or form. Doubling the number of cities by the early 90s, and doubling the population by that period of time. Okay. In 1971, Ceausescu developed what he calls, and what probably is the most famous part of his reign, the July Theses, and his approach to statist communism and socialism. There are five of these. Number one, the complete and total transformation of society. What we mean here specifically is that the entire way of life, way of thought, way of action, way of emotion, is to be radically transformed into purely collective, state-controlled forms of existence. The total transformation of the way people eat and drink and sleep and talk has to be, all of this has to be completely altered by the coercive action of the party. Number two, national service. This becomes absolutely central to the July Theses of 1971, where Ceausescu holds that all Romanians have to serve the state because the state is the manifestation of the Marxist and Leninist ideal. Number three, that education is to be based around Marxist propaganda. And that's really the nature of education, is to take a very young person practically from the womb and rebuild this little human being into a Marxist machine. Number four, the tightening of censorship, that the state has to fully control everything that a human being comes into contact with. And lastly, the removal of the discipline of sociology from all Romanian schools. This is important because there is only one sociological approach, and that is Marxism. The discipline of sociology, the way that it's practiced in the West, is a perversion. And therefore, those kind of so-called social sciences have to be removed from Romanian higher education. Those became the central pillars of Ceausescu's regime in the early 70s, and the July Theses became absolutely central to this very eccentric thing called Romanian Marxism. We're going to finish up this topic when we return. Hang in there.
Don't go away, because there's more to come on The Orthodox Nationalist. You're listening to the Voice of Reason Broadcast Network. Visit us at reasonradionetwork.com. Let's return to The Orthodox Nationalist, brought to you by the Voice of Reason Broadcast Network, reasonradionetwork.com.
Okay, we are back. We are in the midst of talking about the reign of Nicolae Ceausescu in Romania. And we're really focusing largely on the ideology and the sort of eccentric approach to state socialism that Ceausescu is a part of. As many of you remember, riots began in Romania in the early part of December of 89, 20 years ago now. And these riots were really based around the complete failure of the Romanian economy. The personal control of Ceausescu and the Securitate, along with the influence of his wife, Elena, who really, you know, really deserves a show, or really a show really in her own right, because she is just really increasingly a bizarre part of this government. And of course, you know, the army never fully trusting Ceausescu, the army realizing that discipline in the society was largely based in the security police and not in the military. The military very quickly sided with the protesters. The real events that led to Ceausescu's execution as a war criminal were based on the idea that he ordered the Securitate to open fire both on the army, probably not a good idea, and the protesters. It didn't take the Romanian army very long to destroy the Securitate, and although they were elite infantry, and they had their own, you know, armored helicopters and armored personnel carriers and tanks and everything else, they did not have the numbers that were required to engage in an open war with the army. So it didn't take long for the Securitate to really take off their uniforms and mold into the crowd. But it was because Securitate killed a whole lot of people specifically, these were the charges specifically laid at the feet of Ceausescu, and then he was executed on New Calendar Christmas Day. As I mentioned, in 1968, Ceausescu had condemned the Soviet invasion of Czechoslovakia. He did this largely to curry favor with the West. And let me summarize it this way. Ultimately, there are two pillars to his rule. Ceausescu relied on the security forces on the one hand to maintain discipline in the military and elsewhere, but the other pillar was money from the United States. And in leaving the Warsaw Pact, in condemning the invasion of Czechoslovakia, of putting out these symbolic statements against the USSR under Brezhnev, he received some American cash. But as I said before, the economy had largely been dismantled by the early 80s. And in the late 60s, the balance of payments in Romania was so bad that, because, you know, I mean, Romania has oil, they have natural gas, they have tremendously fertile soil. Under competent leadership, Romania should be a fairly wealthy place. But of course, really there's no bureaucratic leadership that's ever really competent. And especially in a country where I think more than any other place in the Soviet bloc, that you had such a radical disconnect between the bureaucracy on the one hand and the political leadership on the other. Ceausescu trusted nobody. And I guess I could say that to a small extent, Ceausescu relied on his wife, Elena, but that Elena had no competence. She received a phony PhD, I think it was in biology, biochem, something like that. You know, under protest from the Romanian Academy of Sciences. She is your classic affirmative action female professor. And I've come across so many of these characters in my career as an academic, which thank God has been over for some time now. But, women are really pushed through their classes to some extent. In American universities, especially in the humanities, I don't know about the sciences necessarily, but they are pushed through their classes. And if you fail a woman, or if a woman leaves the university due to bad grades, the professor, the department in particular, has to answer for this. A white male, it really doesn't matter. But when a woman is removed from the university or fails, the university is now answerable. And certainly the department that fails her is answerable to the state, to the U.S. government, and its various affirmative action laws. I failed people in the past, females in the past, and I received phone calls saying, you must pass this person. And I said, why must I do anything? And they said, well, because she's a woman and we have affirmative action law. We can't fail any more than a certain percentage. And I said, go to hell. So this is one of the reasons why I'm not in academia anymore. I've had calls from deans and assistant deans begging me, please give her a D, anything. I can't have the federal government breathing down my neck. I, of course, said go to hell even louder because, of course, I knew what this was all about. But Elena is your classic example of this. Elena had no education. She had no real ability. But she pretended to be a scientist. And because she was Nikolai's wife, she was eventually put in extremely influential positions, not merely in the Academy of Sciences, not merely at Romanian universities, but also in the bureaucracy itself. So if Ceausescu wasn't irritating enough, I mean, Ceausescu did have legitimate political abilities. He could never have been dictator for so long if he didn't. But Elena had no abilities whatsoever. She was given a PhD for nothing, put in all of these positions. I just can't help but chuckle and say that we have Elenas all over America. I mean, I've even interviewed young female professors in my discipline who don't know anything. I mean, I've tried to talk shop with them over everything, you know. I mean, even things in their own area, and they know nothing. You know, and if you get too upset with that, they'll threaten you and say, I'll go to the university, I'll go to the government, and I'll have you fired. Which, of course, is very possible. But Elena is one of these people, almost like a Rasputin of sorts, who not only had one of the most senior offices in the Communist Party, had veto power over who was promoted and who wasn't. So by the early 80s, I mean, Ceausescu had no support. I mean, at least Marxist governments had a tendency to have some bureaucratic support, if no other place, on the basis that, well, they owe their jobs to the party, they owe their jobs to the government. But Ceausescu even screwed that up, and I think Elena had a lot to do with that. That nowhere in the Soviet bloc did you have such a radical rupture between the bureaucracy at all levels, including the army, which is, you know, a really stupid idea. And Elena was a catalyst for even further disconnect. So by the time he's overthrown in December of 89, Ceausescu had no support, with the exception of the elite units of the Securitate, and that's all he had. Unlike most communist dictators, he did not have military support. He did not have bureaucratic support. I mean, those were key elements in support of Marxist governments throughout the world. And so this whole notion of the July Theses and this radical transformation of humanity that he really based his reign on, the whole point of the July Theses in 71 were that this is sort of the constitution that I'm going to follow for my reign and for my rule. And the whole notion of the censorship and the ideology and the removal of all the social sciences, all of this stuff was designed to create a population so benighted that they couldn't conceivably know how to question the system. And I needn't remind any of my listeners that he got some of these ideas from North Korea. The only real ally that Ceausescu had was the North Korean government. And, you know, I mean, as the economy just spun out of control in the 80s, only the North Koreans maintained any real kind of, you know, trading relationship with Romania. By the early 80s, North Korea was the last government to really have anything to do with Ceausescu. So what Ceausescu was doing is attempting to create a completely hermetically sealed off country dictated to by ideological propaganda in the schools. He attempted to import the North Korean system to Romania, to create a people so ignorant that they are incapable of anything but following the dictates of the regime. And of course, needless to say, Elena had something to do with all of that. And really, by the early 80s, she rules parallel with Ceausescu, with Nicolae. So Nicolae controls Securitate, and what little economic patronage exists. And on the other hand, Elena controls the Academy of Sciences and the party itself. Okay, so what is the legacy of Nicolae Ceausescu? He is one of the most eccentric and bizarre figures in communist history. He was one of the most physically brutal people in an already troubled country, in an already troubled part of the world. But what interests historians, I think, and this is a legitimate interest, is that Ceausescu eventually really descended into madness, really in the, starting in the early 80s. Ceausescu developed what you could only call really a psychosis, where there was no reality other than what he dictated. But I want to say that's part of the Enlightenment European world, that humanity is merely a machine, all of nature is just one big mechanism, and we can make of it and take it apart and put it back together, which is the definition of revolution in the political sense, in the scientific sense, in any way we please, and therefore there really is no reality, because we could take it apart and change it as the alchemists of the Renaissance viewed nature, as permanently malleable and changeable. But probably no one had reached this level of psychosis as seriously as Ceausescu has. The economic failure is something else that really needs to be central to any analysis of Ceausescu. By the mid-80s, it was very clear that the Soviet Union was in big trouble. And in Romania, you probably had the worst of all European economies, and there were no consumer goods. By the mid-80s, there were no consumer goods in Romania, with the exception of a handful of imports that were reserved for those close to Ceausescu personally and high-ranking members of the Securitate. But when I say consumer goods, I'm talking everything from, you know, automobiles to toothbrushes to toothpaste to medical care to the access to medical equipment. Romanian hospitals were emptied by the early 80s. Medical equipment that was received from the Warsaw Pact, from the Soviet Union, from the United States, from the Chinese, from the North Koreans, were dismantled and shipped overseas to pay for imports. You have one of the most fertile countries in Europe that had to pay for almost all of its food. By the middle of the 1970s, the Romanian economy was almost non-existent. By the late 1970s, electricity was only available occasionally. Regular blackouts, even in Bucharest itself, were pretty regular. You had a few hours of electricity a day, even in the major cities. The only people who had access to generators and gasoline were, of course, the Ceausescu family, those politicians close to them, and high-ranking members of the Securitate. By 1981, the official Securitate position was that they would now be in charge of the rationing of food and even of basic things like clothing and heating oil and everything else. The creation of these artificial villages, as I mentioned before, the systematization of creating these agricultural cities led to massive food shortage. By 1989, the Romanian economy was roughly the equal to Ghana. And that's really the complete lack of access to even basic amenities, running water and everything else, led to the riots of 1989. And really what you have right now is still a Romanian country that has no real civic life, that has no honest politics, that is still at a fourth world, still a fourth world status. As of 2009, December 29th, which is today's date, 2009, you still do not have any real economic movement. You have a population that has been so twisted and distorted as their economy, really as their birth rate plunges. You know, the economic experimentation of Ceausescu really led to the poisoning of the water, the poisoning of the soil. You have tremendous, not only physical illness in Romania, but mental illness coming from all of this, coming from this desire to remake nature as one big machine that could be controlled from Bucharest. That's really the legacy, not only of Ceausescu, but of Marxism, of statism, and of Enlightenment alchemy, all of these coming together to create this specifically Marxist and statist world, descending deeper and deeper, not only into Ceausescu's personal mental illness and psychosis, which is really never effectively treated, but also the psychosis of the society as a whole, and Romania still. And I could be exaggerating this, but it seems to me that Romania still has not recovered from this era. And who knows if they will. I certainly hope so. So anyway, yes, this is a very depressing thing, but it is fitting to do this today. It's almost exactly 20 years ago that Ceausescu was executed, and I want to thank my friends for recommending this topic for me, because it's certainly worthwhile. To what sort of a person that Ceausescu was, and I'm willing to say that the personality that was Nicolae Ceausescu is not all that rare, at least among the powerful in Western societies. Anyway, I want to thank all of my friends for listening. I appreciate your support, and I will talk to you next time. Bye bye.
Thanks for listening. The Orthodox Nationalist returns Thursday evening, 9 to 10 p.m. Eastern U.S. time. Join us at ReasonRadioNetwork.com.